Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic View Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.theorganicview.com. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@theorganicview.com. Today's show is sponsored by RamVPN.com, the leading provider of next-generation online anonymity and VPN security solutions. Their architecture is unique, tamper-safe, and 100% guaranteed. They even accept Bitcoin. Listeners of the Organic View Radio Show can receive a 15% discount in 3-month and 6-month personal plans by using the coupon code ORGVIEW. That's ORGVIEW. For more promotional offers, please visit our website at www.theorganicview.com. Also, don't forget to check out our contest section on our website for your chance to win one of our cool prizes. For more information, please visit www.theorganicview.com/contest.
Over the years, numerous lawsuits have been filed against the U.S. EPA by beekeepers and other concerned citizens in an effort to protect honeybees. Excuse me. Although the global population of honeybees and other pollinators continues to decline, EPA continues to take action at a glacial pace. On today's show, Tom and I are going to talk to Greg Laurie from Earth Justice about several lawsuits against EPA regarding the protection of honeybees. So first, I'd like to welcome to the show Tom Theobald. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hello, June.
And do we have a weather report today?
Well, yeah, it's a sunny afternoon, but we've got big thunderheads building, and you may hear the thunder in the background as we speak, because we're about to get pounded, I think.
I know our listeners always look forward to hearing that. And joining us today is Mr. Greg Laurie, who's a staff attorney at Earth Justice. Good afternoon, Greg.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Greg, can you share with our listeners a little bit about your work at Earth Justice?
Sure. We are currently in the midst of several legal battles involving systemic insecticides, including neonicotinoids. And it's been really a privilege to be representing the commercial beekeeping industry in several of these matters. One of the most exciting is a challenge to U.S. EPA's decision to register a sort of next-generation neonicotinoid called sulfoxaflor back in the summer of 2013. And we brought suit in federal court in San Francisco challenging that decision on the grounds that EPA registered sulfoxaflor without any real information about what the impact would be on honeybee hives from exposure over time on honeybee hives. They have historically simply looked at the level of sulfoxaflor or any other pesticide for that matter that is needed to kill an adult honeybee on spot. And of course, what we know about the global honeybee crisis that we're in now is that it's really an issue of this chronic exposure to sometimes small levels of an insecticide over time that are causing the colonies, the entire colony, to collapse outright. So it really is a fundamental shortcoming in the way EPA has been doing its analysis.
Thank you. Tom, can you share with our listeners a little bit of the history with a chemical called sulfoxaflor?
Well, as Greg said, this is kind of a next generation neonicotinoid. They've changed the name and they claim that it isn't a neonicotinoid, but it's very similar. But I became involved in this by way of what became the infamous leaked memo. It had to do with the conditional approval of clothianidin, one of the early neonicotinoids. And one of the critical ingredients, elements of that conditional registration was a life cycle study that was to have been conducted within the first year and languished for several years. Finally was completed and turned out to be virtually bogus. And I became involved with by way of what was called the leaked memo. And Bayer came back to the EPA and asked for additional approval for clothianidin on mustard and cotton. And they were asking for its use on cotton because they claimed that the current pesticides were failing. Well, that lasted for 2 years, and then apparently, or at least according to what we were told, clothianidin was failing, and the follow-on product was, surprise, surprise, sulfoxaflor. But what the interesting part about sulfoxaflor is that the EPA had come under considerable criticism because of its abuse of the conditional registration. The leaked memo really highlighted that. And the contention is that even today, 12 years later, clothianidin still has not met the requirements for legal registration, but the EPA went ahead and registered it anyway. So with sulfoxaflor, there were many of those same questions outstanding. And what the EPA did was, rather than give it a conditional registration and examine those serious questions over time, they decided to do a complete end run and just give it a full registration. And what that does, and maybe Greg can explain a little better from a legal standpoint, but what that means is, had they given it a conditional registration, of course there would have been conditions, and we would have monitored those conditions, and we would have probably been challenging them all along the way. If they give it a full registration, then by law, they're not required to revisit that decision for 15 years. So that's how sulfoxaflor has fitted into this drama that's gone on. Well, the leaked memo was in November of 2010, and here we are in 2015.
Greg, how has the conditional registration privilege been abused?
Well, let me first say that Tom is precisely right with respect to the history of sulfoxaflor. EPA initially, I think this would have been in April of 2013, EPA initially proposed and advised the public that it was going to conditionally register sulfoxaflor, and it proposed to condition that registration on the timely submission of these long-term studies on colony-wide impacts. And Tom is precisely right that after that conditional proposed registration came out, we get a lot of blowback, including a very scathing report from the GAO office in Washington, D.C., pointing out that EPA has been doing many of these conditional registrations and hasn't been following through, so that the studies that were required just simply never appear. We have no necessarily proof that this is what happened, but my best guess is that EPA saw that and said, well, this isn't a good time to issue yet another conditional registration. We'll just go ahead and make this an unconditional pesticide. And Tom's precisely right. What that meant was that we're not going to get the studies that EPA was initially proposing to require. They're simply not being done. EPA simply tried to sort of sweep the whole problem under the rug and say, it's good enough, we have what we need, we'll be done with this. And that's really front and center as to what this lawsuit's about. But in response, I guess, to your question, certainly this is not, as I mentioned, this is not, sulfoxaflor is not unique in the fact that it was initially proposed for conditional registration. EPA uses this, really abuses this loophole in the law, when really the law is very clear that you're not supposed to approve these pesticides until you have the information in front of you and until you actually know what the risks will be, both to human health and the environment and food safety and honeybees and everything else.
Greg, could you give us a little overview of the currently active lawsuits and just how they fit into these questions and this picture? As I understand it, there are three that are active at the moment.
Sure, I can try. I mean, I can't tell you that I necessarily am aware of every legal action that's going on out there, but certainly we've talked about the challenge to sulfoxaflor. There is another lawsuit pending in federal district court in San Francisco, brought by several beekeepers and the Center for Food Safety, which really gets at precisely this issue of conditional registration of clothianidine and thiamethoxin, which are two of the sort of older generation neonicotinoids. That case has been ongoing and is still going, but really it gets to this fundamental question of whether EPA needs to go back and redo its analysis and in the interim suspend those pesticides pending the information that it needs on colony impacts. We are also representing several groups in California state court challenging not US EPA, but challenging the California Department of Pesticide Regulations treatment of neonicotinoids writ large. And it's an interesting case because in California, the State Department of Pesticide Regulation determined way back in 2009 that there was evidence that existing use of neonicotinoids was having an unanticipated impact on honeybee colonies. And so they put the pesticides into what they call reevaluation. What that is supposed to mean is that they go back and they sort of take a second look and say, did we get something wrong? Do we need more information? Do we need to put additional mitigation measures in place? That sort of thing. Unfortunately, what we found in California is that pesticides that go into reevaluation tend to stay in reevaluation, and they tend to stay there for a really long time, and meanwhile, nothing changes. So since 2009, the Department of Pesticide Regulation has continued to register new uses for neonicotinoid pesticides, has continued to expand the use of these insecticides in California without any environmental analysis, without any new studies, all the while acknowledging that there's a problem. So the lawsuit in California is getting at that issue of sort of expanded use in the absence of information and digging the hole deeper while we know we have a problem. And then finally, there are several cases around the country challenging EPA's chronic failure to consult with the expert wildlife agencies, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service, over the impact that registering pesticides could have on imperiled species in America. This is a chronic problem with every pesticide where EPA just takes the position that it need not consult with these expert agencies on the impact of the insecticides or the pesticides on threatened and endangered species. And so there are several lawsuits that are challenging that issue specifically. So I don't know if that's a complete canvassing. I'm certain there are several other cases as well, but those are the ones that I'm aware of off the cuff.
No, those are the main ones, and I think it's helpful. It's hard for even for those of us who are involved on a daily level to understand this, and even more difficult for a lot of the listeners. And the concern is that it appears to those of us on the receiving end that the EPA goes to the laws and the regulations not to understand what their responsibilities are, but to devise some plan to avoid those responsibilities.
Well, I would agree that it's important to bear in mind that the primary federal law that regulates pesticide use in America, it's called the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, or FIFRA. It really was not envisioned and originally put together as a law intended to protect human health or the environment. It was a law that was designed really as a consumer protection law to prevent the consumers from being sold snake oil and other products that really didn't do anything at all. It wasn't until the 1970s that Congress attempted to sort of add on some protections to ensure that use of these products would not also cause cancer or kill things like honeybees and the very insects that we need to keep our agricultural systems going. And frankly, the law is quite weak. The law gives a tremendous amount of deference to the agencies to sort of try and do the right thing. And these are agencies, this is EPA in particular, is under a huge amount of pressure from a relatively small number of pesticide manufacturing companies to get these products to the market. The law is set up such that the industry, they're the ones who submit the science in support of their proposals and their applications. They pay for the studies to be done. They send them to EPA. They decide which studies should be sent to EPA. A large amount of this information is kept confidential in the name of confidential business information and preventing folks from free riding on somebody else's research. But the net effect of that is that we often don't really know exactly what the impact of these insecticides will be until we have a huge crisis on our hands. And certainly that's what we're seeing with respect to bees, where it's taken a crisis of really unprecedented proportions, where we're losing now 40% of our honeybee colonies each year. And all of a sudden, we're looking around and we realize, boy, EPA never was even requiring the information about what the impact of these insecticides would be on honeybee colonies. That simply wasn't a question that they were asking, and that's wrong.
Folks,
yeah,
on
I
the
think
one...
the losses are even higher than that, Greg. The 40% is very conservative. If you talk with commercial beekeepers, the turnover of their population in the course of a season is approaching 100%, and in some cases exceeding that. So this is an environmental disaster, certainly for those of us who are in the commercial end of beekeeping.
Folks, joining us on the line is Graham White calling in from Scotland. Graham, are you there? Graham, continue. I think there was a little bit of trouble hearing you. Can you say that again?
Maybe you could transmit his questions, June, because it doesn't sound like his sound is coming through.
I see. Graham was just saying it's fascinating to hear about everything that the folks are doing at Earth's Justice, or at Earth Justice as far as this lawsuit is concerned. And we're having a little bit of a technical problem, so I'm sorry about that. In any event, Tom, you were just about to say something.
I'm not sure what it was. Whatever it is, it's escaped into the ozone.
Well, Tom, one of the things that I saw circulating was this new claim that it's climate change that's causing the decline. So could you expand upon that for our listeners?
Well, you know, climate change may have an effect on the environment, but bees are very flexible and adaptable honeybees, and they can survive in a wide range of environments. So while climate change may have some effect on a broad scale, what this really is looking for excuses, you know, looking for any excuse that they can come up with that will take the focus off the neonicotinoids. And it's clear to anyone who's looking at this with an open mind that the neonicotinoids have been a major driver in these losses. Not the only thing. There are other things that are contributing, but the neonicotinoids are the primary driver. And it's disgraceful for the EPA to continue to turn its back on this. And I think it's evidence of the fact that they're being directed by their corporate handlers.
Well, we've seen so many different excuses circulate. And I guess, Greg, the question is, how many lawsuits will it take for EPA to take action?
Well, it's a good question. And you know, I try not to think about it in those terms. I think ultimately what it will take is public outcry. And I think we're seeing that. I mean, I frankly think that folks are starting to understand exactly the scope of this problem. They understand that this is not just a problem for beekeepers. It's a problem for anyone that eats food and wants a healthy diet. We have to bear in mind that, you know, one-third of our diet comes from crops that won't make fruit or seed unless they're visited by a honeybee. And as luck would have it, it's the healthiest third. It's the nuts, the fruits, the berries, all the stuff that we really ought to be eating. So I think that at the end of the day, EPA responds when they hear loud and vocal voices I think that litigation can bring those voices, can give them a microphone, and can give people a sort of very concrete thing to rally behind. But ultimately, what's going to change this is when people demand action, and I think we're starting to see that happening.
Thank you, Greg. Greg, I just want to say thank you so much for joining us today. Could you let our listeners know how they can support your efforts at Earth Justice?
Sure. Our website is www.earthjustice.org. There is a page on the website that talks a lot about the work that we're doing with respect to bees, and folks are encouraged to go and check it out, and we certainly welcome and greatly appreciate public support. It's what keeps us going.
Thank you. And Tom, thank you also for coming on the show today. As we say every week, to be continued.
Well, I hope we don't have to continue it forever. I don't know how much longer we can last, but I want to thank Greg for taking the time to talk to us and help us understand a little better just what the intricacies of these issues are.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. And folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Sawyer with the Organic Bee Radio Show. Have a great afternoon.